Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We have a short here tonight talking about the firing of John Harbaugh. Joining me, Jonas Schaefer of the Baltimore Banner. Jonas, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Ken. How are you?
All right. Appreciate you get up here at 1 a.m. in the morning here to do this pod with me. But it's the kind of thing, obviously, timely information. We want to have it out as quickly as possible. Harbaugh fired after 18 seasons today, 12 playoff appearances, one Super Bowl, three other AFC championship losses. Won over 60% of his games, 180 and 113, and 13 and 11 in the postseason, which is a record a lot of non-Belichicks would take in their career. There aren't a whole lot of wins to go around in the postseason, and when Belichick takes a heap and helping of them out of there, Andy Reid as well, there's not a lot left for the other coaches, but John Harbaugh was one of the successful ones. What's your biggest takeaway from this?
It's still shock, honestly. I predicted that we would get a scalp in this week. I did not think it would be John Harbaugh's. I think my prevailing belief was that Steve Bisciotti and everyone else at the Castle has seen how John Harbaugh has evolved in times where he's needed to evolve, and that maybe one more season, giving him one more chance to right the ship and have this postseason breakthrough that has eluded John in the Lamar era, could be what he needed to fix things and figure things out. I thought that, you know, you might see a Todd Monken dismissal or a Zach Orr dismissal. Obviously, I think the Zach Orr dismissal would have made more sense in the hypothetical world where John Harbaugh still has his job. But it sounds like there was just too many things that Steve Bisciotti and John Harbaugh could not agreed to disagree about it. And there obviously was a breaking point, and Steve didn't have any compunction about firing a guy who still had 3 years left on that contract through 2028, I guess it would have been. So yeah, I mean, like I'd be lying to you if I said I didn't have the pre-write ready for John Harbaugh is out as Baltimore Ravens coach, but it still was shocking to me. Because, and I can attest to that because I was writing the Zach Orr's fired story as the news broke. So it's just all very, very shocking. I thought that if something were to happen with John, it would actually happen later in the week after, you know, cooler heads would have prevailed, but clearly I was wrong, and now John Harbaugh's back on the market and the Ravens are in the mix for a new coach.
I was an intern at Channel 2 in 1985. Okay. And one of the things they had me write that summer was obituary pieces on some of the 1983 world champion Orioles. So Len Sicada and Joe Nolan, I had to write up little blurbs about them, expecting them to be released during that 1985 season. I can imagine how those obit pieces written in advance are for you. Yeah. I know some of the newspapers, they have obit pieces in advance for just like famous people in general.
Sometimes you get the weird circumstance of having an obit published on a recently deceased individual, and the obit is written by an obit writer who is also no longer with us.
Dead,
writing about the dead.
All right, just a little bit of insight there. Very big news, big change, big risk, I think, for the organization. I mean, anytime you make a new hire at head coach, it's a potential inflection point for the organization. The Ravens having been riding high for basically so long, for most of the Harbaugh era, most of the inflection that can occur is, I would say, down. That's not to say it's not the right thing to do with a player like Lamar Jackson that you're trying to, get to the next level, get past the next bump. But agree with that? There's a risk down and up for this?
Yeah. I mean, the goal every season is to get into the dance, get into the tournament, get into the playoffs. And I'm not, breaking any news here that the biggest reason why there has been this simmering, boiling over discontent with John Harbaugh is that the Ravens have had incredible teams do nothing in the playoffs. Like he had as many teams in the Lamar era finish the regular season number one in DVOA, which accounts for opponents, accounts for overall efficiency, accounts for so many factors. And I know you're obviously a big supporter of what Aaron Schatz has done, but he had three number one teams from 2018 to 2024, and he had three playoff wins from 2018 to 2024. You could say, if you were, a John Harbaugh defender, that if you have that level of success, if you keep on playing out those similar rolls of the dice, eventually you're going to hit snake eyes and you're going to win that second title. But you could also say, we are willing as an organization, as an ownership group, you know, led by Steve Bisciotti, that we can take on the risk of having regression to the mean, but maybe that means that maybe we believe that there will be a better chance of a Super Bowl title. Now, obviously, the chances of the next coach lasting anywhere near as long as John Harbaugh did are pretty infinitesimal. I mean, it was funny that you mentioned, Ken, just the Orioles of it all, because I was shocked to go back and find that John Harbaugh is the longest serving coach, not just in Ravens history, but in Baltimore professional sports history. Like, that gives you a sense
longer than Weaver?
Yes.
Is that right? So Weaver was 68 to 82. You're right. 15 years. So,
right.
And then he came back, but you're probably talking continuously, or maybe you're including that.
Yeah. And, but you are just counting, I guess, on the fact that you have this window with Lamar. You didn't think that John Harbaugh, with however he wanted to do it, was going to get you there with Lamar. And, you know, to hell with the possibility that the next guy's floor might be lower than John Harbaugh's. If you think that John Harbaugh had, for whatever reason, hit his ceiling as it related to postseason prospects, then sure, that by all means, go out and fire the guy, pay him the money that he's owed, bring in someone else, bring in a play caller, bring in whoever you think is going to be the guy. But it's just, you know, we're both fans of numbers, Ken. Like, the odds of the next guy having the kind of success that John Harbaugh had, at least in the regular season, are very, very slim.
Yeah, I would agree. Extremely slim. And a lot of it will be, you know, based on what the players do, and most specifically what Lamar does over the next few years. I'm expecting a very broad change. Before that, though, let's get into, I think the it was nice to see the comments made by both Harbaugh, who obviously must have written this email from his desk or something,
had an emoji in it.
Yeah, it had that look that he wrote it. He might have done it from his desk at home, for that matter. But he wrote it, and it was, you know, sent out by Chad Steele on behalf of the Ravens or to the Ravens reporters, and released on Twitter that way and all. And Steve Bisciotti, very classy, you know, polished thing. I'd expect nothing less from him in terms of how it went. There was some discontent from individuals I've heard from that John did not specifically thank the fans for his time in Baltimore. Thank the players, thank the owner, thank God, didn't thank the fans. I don't know how you feel about that, or if you feel it's a bad thing. I'm not really bothered by it, but somebody pointed out to me, it just seemed a little weird. And it's one of those things that, I think the Ravens probably would have exercised some control over what got released. You know, Chad Steele probably would have looked at it. I'm surprised that Chad didn't say something and say, John, do you want to thank the fans here? You know, shouldn't that be part of what you do? It's just a little surprising. Are you reading it now just to confirm what I'm saying?
Yeah, I kind of skimmed over once I saw every other word capitalized. I don't really put a whole lot of stock into it. I think probably the fans who were pissed off by the, you know, fans at the end of the bar comment were never going to come back around. So I think if you were a John Harbaugh fan before this, then this statement isn't going to change anything. If you were a John Harbaugh hater, this statement isn't going to change anything. And I think if you were someone who was on the fence, you probably are just, you know, too busy looking at the head coaching candidates list.
Yeah. That's probably true. I'm going to ask you to mind me, maybe we'll go through these six items that I have ready to go here. And this is something I really want to get your opinion on, because you'll be level-headed about this. Rank these items on a 1 to 5 scale. We'll call it a 0 to 5 scale. I always heard from other people who did rankings that if you rank things 0 to 5, there's no question about which is the low end of the scale. So in terms of the importance of this thing leading to the firing. So we'll start with the lack of playoff success in the Lamar era, 0 to 5 in terms of the importance of this relative to this firing.
So are we doing like these are independent of one another?
All independent. Like, all independent. Okay. So you could have six fives if you really wanted to. Gotcha, then I'd call you a marketer for doing that because they always have 6-8 priorities and nothing is lower.
I guess I would say I would say four, you know, probably somewhere between a 3 and a 4, but closer to 4, just because I think this team, this front office, this ownership thought that this was a team that was poised to break through, and they did not even break through into the playoffs. And you look around the league and Josh Allen is playing on a bum foot with a terrible defense. Patrick Mahomes is not even in the playoffs. Every single team in this AFC field is vulnerable. You have the Seahawks with Mike McDonald kind of rubbing in your faces with their run to the one seed. I don't know if the Ravens make that kick and they go out and get blown out 20-3 by the Texans, if we're still having this conversation, but it's just pushed back a week because of whatever fundamental disagreements John Harbaugh and Steve Bisciotti might have had about Lamar or Todd Monken or about how certain things are done. But I do think this has to ring pretty high with Steve Bisciotti and his desire to add another Lombardi trophy to that trophy case while he's still the owner here.
Yeah. It's a great point. I think it was central. I'd say a 4. I could have been convinced into a 5, but a 4 I think is probably the right thing. Number 2, the eroding relationship with Lamar. Now there've been some indications of this. I thought, you know, Lamar probably had an opportunity on Sunday night with his answer to the question to just, you know, dispel that. And so, you know, Coach and I are really close. He could have said anything like that, but instead he said, you know, we just lost a game. I'm in shock. I'm not ready to talk about that yet, effectively.
I don't think John and Lamar had an eroding relationship. I think it's never going to be as, you know, I don't think John and Lamar were ever as kumbaya as, you know, Patrick Mahomes and Andy Reid are in Kansas City, for instance. But, you know, we heard just last week or the week before when Lamar was asked about his relationship with John Harbaugh, prompted by the Mike Preston column. Like, he feels like he has a good relationship with Harbaugh. He doesn't feel like he's checked out, or John Harbaugh doesn't feel like Lamar's checked out. So I still think there was a lot of mutual respect and love and admiration there. I mean, one of the scenes that I'll remember from that game against the Steelers was, you know, before Lamar got to the podium, he's just off the side, sitting on a chair. John Harbaugh takes his last question, which ironically is, do you want another shot with this team next year? Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course I do. He walks off and he hugs Lamar. They dap each other up. It's not icy at all. It's, you know, like something you would see after any normal win, any normal loss. So I don't know, you know, Lamar led with this. Lamar is inscrutable. Lamar doesn't let a lot of people in. I don't know if whoever it is that takes over, whether it's Cliff Kingsbury or Dan Lanning or someone we've never even heard of, is going to be a guy who Lamar, you know, at, you know, his kid's baptism, like 15 years down the road, is going to be inviting the next coach to that and have him front and center. I just don't think Lamar is that kind of guy with people who he hasn't really grown up with and hasn't really known all of his life. So I think this is pretty low. Certainly the relationship could have been better. I think the fact that it's been 3 years now in the past 5 that we've had John Harbaugh and Lamar Jackson be on seemingly different injury recovery timetables is not great, and something that, you know, Nick Wright at Fox Sports I think keeps on harping on. But, you know, that's what you kind of get when you are dealing with Lamar, and just the general lack of regular communication that you might get with other quarterbacks.
Right. That's often been something that's been pointed out. And I know Jeff C has been on this before, that, you know, there's nothing about the relationship that's normal in terms of trying to negotiate a contract, because he just won't necessarily return your phone call.
Yeah.
And, you know, I, you know, it's hard to deal with that. Anyway, let's keep going down there. The blown leads are something that's been brought up as the central factor in the Harbaugh era. How big a factor? 1 to 5 or 0 to 5 is that?
I think probably closer to 1. Yeah. I just think, like, will Ravens fans be beating their chests about the next coach if he becomes this guy who is aces in, you know, one score games, but he wins just the exact same amount of games that John Harbaugh does, who won a lot of blowouts, but because of how many games that the Ravens led by double digits in the third quarter and the fourth quarter, was naturally vulnerable to some of those leads disappearing, you know, quick as a whisper. That is something I'm kind of curious to get my finger on the pulse of this fan base. Like, would you settle for a coach who gives up fewer leads, but also doesn't have the team to blow teams out? Like, the Ravens have blown out a lot of teams under John Harbaugh, a lot of teams. Like, I think only maybe the Chiefs and Bills, I randomly looked this up early in the season, like, had beaten more teams by double digits or like by 14 plus points or 20 plus points. Like, the Ravens have done.
You don't even have to.
A lot of teams.
You don't even have to go to that depth, because if you just look back to the beginning of the 2018 season, which is the Lamar era, although he didn't play the first few games that year, the Ravens have an enormous advantage in net scoring over the rest of the league. So you if you just go with that, I mean, you know, Pythagorean basis or whatever, they should have won more games than they did. The frustrating thing that has been, there's a team in the division who's won a lot more than they should have in the Steelers, and there's a team in Kansas City that has a frustrating record of winning one score games that is just you know, it's been a constant thorn in the side of people who are bothered by it. But
the one year regresses is the year that the Ravens don't even make the playoffs.
Yeah. So I hope not. So many things. Okay. So I'd go with you, maybe 1.5 or 2 on that at most. Here's one I think came up today as a bigger issue, that he might have had too much loyalty to some of his coordinators and assistants. Where's that on the 0 to 5 scale or 1 to 5?
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it's closer to 5 than any of us could have imagined. The thing that is interesting to me in all this is that, Steve Bisciotti was willing to let John Harbaugh hold on to Greg Roman for 1 year longer than he should have, but apparently was not willing to give him that same kind of leash with Todd Monken. I don't know if everything that the national insiders have put out today or put out on Tuesday was necessarily accurate. Like, I think just from talking to guys in the locker room and knowing guys in the locker room, the idea that John Harbaugh, quote, lost the locker room, as a primary reason for why he no longer has a job seems a little bit shaky to me. But if he lost John Harbaugh to a degree that perhaps we're all unaware of, then I think that is just as important as losing.
If Harbaugh lost Bisciotti?
If Harbaugh lost Lamar, excuse me.
Lamar, yes.
Yes, losing Lamar is just as important as losing the rest of the locker room. And if that's the case, then, you know, I guess your hand is forced. I'm curious to see what comes out about Todd Monken over the next couple days, weeks, whatever. I mean, it seems like it's probably pretty likely that if John Harbaugh goes to a place where he can pick his own staff, then he's going to pick the offensive coordinator who in 2 of the past 3 years had an MVP level coach, MVP level quarterback, and a top 5 offense by DVOA, and, you know, showed some of the same strokes of brilliance that he did at Georgia, where he was a 2-time national championship winning offensive coordinator. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. I mean, obviously, I think, you know, the great thing about John is his loyalty, but that has been a double-edged sword, because he gets guys who are willing to fight for him and go to bat for him. But then you have situations like the Steve Saunders situation that becomes toxic. You have Greg Roman stick around for too long. And even though I thought Todd Monken was worthy of, you know, another year in Baltimore, I don't know. I mean, like, if I'm John Harbaugh and I want to stamp my ticket to Canton, Ohio, I feel like probably the easiest, the fastest path to doing that is swallowing your pride, picking a new offensive coordinator, and then running it back next year. And maybe, you know, you, everything breaks your way and you get that second Super Bowl title and you become iconic and legendary and no one can doubt your bona fides for the rest of your life. But John wants what he wants. He likes what he likes. And if Todd Monken was the breaking point, which it sounds like it might have been, then I guess that's what we're going to have to kind of reckon with.
Isn't it a little bit surprising given the banter that's gone back and forth between the two of them, Monken and Harbaugh this year? I mean, you're closer to this than I am. I really got the sense that there was a certain friction. There's certainly been parts of the fan base, and everybody's trying to throw gasoline on any relationship problem Harbaugh might have. Okay, that's first of all, that's the Twitterverse right now. And if Harbaugh, I mean, this talk that Harbaugh threw Monken onto the bus at midseason, then that Monken then, you know, basically talking back at him and saying, you know, talking back is not the right word. It's responding to that, but by saying, look, he says a lot of things over the headset. Some of it's good advice, some of it's bad advice. And it was very much like, I'm going to do my own thing at the end of that. It didn't seem like Monken and Harbaugh had some great relationship the way that the talk went this year.
I think John said a lot of that, knowing that Todd could take it. Like, he's a thin-skinned guy. He was an offensive coordinator for an SEC school, and not just any SEC school, Georgia. I think you develop some pretty thick skin along the way. Like, he's the kind of guy who's not afraid to dish it and to dish out hard coaching. And if you're unafraid to be a coach who coaches guys hard, then I don't think you can stand up there every week and not expect to be coached hard yourself by the head coach. So it would have been interesting to like play the thought experiment game of if it were, you know, Zach Orr doing questionable stuff like cover zero over and over again that cost the Ravens a game. Would John Harbaugh have been willing to go out there and be as public with some of his criticism as he was with Todd Monken, knowing that, and obviously this kind of goes into another kind of realm here, but Zach Orr is definitely more popular in the Ravens locker room than Todd Monken is. You know, we did reporting on it. The Sun did reporting on it. It became clear with certain guys talking, certain guys not talking about what this offense is, what it could be, what it should have been, all that kind of stuff.
Chuck Smith, Roquan Smith have stood up for Orr in a big way. That's two important people, but Chuck Smith at the podium just was effusive about Orr in terms of how he was the guy who turned the defense around. It wasn't the fact that they brought in Dean Pease for oversight or that, you know, all the other things. And you know, there are some questions. There's a lot of coaches. Would you, before we go on to this, you agree there's going to be a fairly significant evolution of the coaching staff from top to bottom? You know, a mix of people who are leaving with Harbaugh for whatever job he has, you know, a week from now.
I think it's inevitable because I think let's start with the three types of coaches you can hire. You can hire an CEO type. I don't think that they will, just because of the types of candidates who are out there. Mm-hmm. If you hire a Mike McDonald-like coach who's going to call plays and call the defense, then Zach Orr has no reason to stick around in Baltimore because nothing that he would do under that coach could be helpful for him in the least bit in furthering his own career. Like, you get NFL head coaching jobs by being a play-calling defensive coordinator. You don't get it unless you're like, you know, one of Andy Reid's many offensive minions in Kansas City who can just kind of stand in the shadow of Andy Reid and maybe get credit for enough good calls that you can get a head coaching job somewhere. But I don't think
Eric,
that's realistic.
Eric Bieniemy is the ultimate poster boy for not being able to succeed under a offensive-minded head coach. I mean, he was a head coaching candidate for years, right?
And if you're an offensive play call, and actually before I talk about offensive play calling coach, I guess there is the possibility that like a Robert Saleh, for instance, if he suddenly shoots up the list and becomes a top candidate for Steve Bisciotti, like he did not call the plays for the Jets going back and looking at his time there. So there would be a possibility that someone like Zach Orr and Robert Saleh could coexist. It would be a weird kind of setup, because I don't think, you know, Salah would come here and, you know, willingly inherit the guy who a lot of the Ravens fan base has already said, no mas, we don't want this guy back. But I guess that's always a possibility. And then with the offensive, you know, play caller type, I think that he probably would want his own guy. And I think of the two coordinators currently on staff with the Ravens, Todd Monken is the more qualified. I think he's the better one. It's possible that, you know, there is enough goodwill in that building from the players or the coaching staff or Steve Bisciotti that they give Zach Orr another good look. I mean, like this defense, we're only a year away from this defense, only a year removed from this defense being number six in DVOA. One of the fascinating stats that I found, Ken, looking at some of the FTN data, was even though the Ravens did not get after the quarterback very well in terms of pressure rate, they did have the fastest average time to pressure in the entire NFL, which to me points to, hey, the scheme, when it is hitting, does a really, really good job, like a Mike McDonald level good job, but you just don't have the horses or you don't have the guys, you know, confident enough to play fast and get there often enough. But yeah, it seems like for me, the only guy who would probably be pretty safe in his job would be Chris Horton.
Okay, I think that would be Chuck Smith, I would think is fair. Okay, you're talking about the coordinator level, meaning the special teams coordinator, yeah. is safe. Okay, so I think Chuck Smith, for example, is safe. I think Randy Brown is safe if he wants to stay.
I would push back against Chuck Smith.
Really?
Just, again, like, I think I had higher expectations for a lot of people on this edge rush group. I know that, you know, Namdi, this would be, I forget, was Chuck Smith's first year the breakout for Namdi or the year after?
I think it was 23, but I'm not 100% sure. I think he's been here 3 years.
So
I'll look, like, it up on Wiki.
A lot of those sacks, when you go back and look at it, like, yes, Namdi has definitely gotten better as a pass rusher, but, and I pointed this out at the time, like, a lot of those were just Namdi benefiting from really creatively scheme pick stunts, like Patrick Queen blowing up the guy that Namdi was going up against, and Matabike just having a you know, scot-free path to the quarterback. You look at the lack of development from Adafe Owe this year. You look at just, you know, how long it took someone as strong and gifted as Travis Jones to be able to, a guy who could, you know, reliably give you 3 to 4 pressures a game. I expected a lot more from Mike Green this year. The fact that he could not get himself into a position where he was taking meaningful third down snaps away from Kyle Van Noy at this stage in his career, mm-hmm. In that game against Pittsburgh, to me was pretty shocking. Like, all this hype about Tavius Robinson being like a hugely impactful pass rusher in the preseason has turned out to be complete bunk. And, you know, I kind of have my issues with the ESPN rate stats, like the pass rush win rate, pass block win rate, run block win rate, et cetera, et cetera. But I think for the past 2 years, the Ravens have ranked like bottom eight at minimum in pass rush win rate. And sure, they were able to finish second in the NFL in sacks last year. But I think you can say a lot of that was just because they were playing with the leads so dang often. And these guys just had opportunity after opportunity to go against these quarterbacks who were taking 3 to 3.5 seconds to get the ball downfield, because they knew that they needed big plays to have a chance of coming back to some of those games.
I mean, there's a part of that. In 23 and 24, they did a good job of leveraging the leads they had. By the way, Chuck Smith been here since 23. I don't disagree with it. Let's go on to a couple other things. Actually, I'll just put these two in the same category. Inexplicable losses in big moments that aren't comeback wins, I guess, because we already talked about them, and game management mistakes. Either of those a significant factor in terms of the firing?
Inexplicable losses and big
moments. I'll give you one that I'll toss in there. Maybe I can answer this one first, because I've actually been thinking about it today. So in 23, they lost the game when Zay Flowers Fair caught the free kick against Indianapolis. That was a really bad loss that was probably coaching related. Then people make a really big deal about him calling two consecutive timeouts. It's a stupid move, but it happens, and it wasn't game changing in the time that it does. And if people are going to map that to mistakes he's going to make all over the place, it's very spurious to me. the one that you could point to just from this last weekend, which I don't know if you see my pods or videos on the thing, but I'm very down on the fact that they didn't have the code word in the huddle for Zay Flowers to go down near the goal line. And
I thought you were gonna rail on Harbs for not trying to get the ball closer than 44 yard field goal.
No, I'm not reeling on that at all. Because I mean, he's right. If we'd see an all out blitz from Pittsburgh, Lamar would have to get rid of the ball quickly. Maybe he connects on it. Maybe he gets sacked. Maybe there's things that can happen that are negative and positive. And 44 is close enough. It didn't have to be closer than that for Tyler Loop. It'd been perfect, right? Between 40 and 49. Not the greatest conditions. It's cold. You know, it's a bad situation. But I'm not, you know, my problem, I'm not blaming Loop for losing the game. My problem is that they put the hands back in the game back in the hands of their defense when they didn't need to. So they allowed the go-ahead score to occur when Pittsburgh didn't have any freaking timeouts. And you got to punish a team for that. And I'm okay with either method, by the way, which is method number one is you run the ball on third and one. And you get closer and you slow play it in that manner. I'm also okay just saying, don't score. Go down at the 1 yard line if you have to. And then you can easily get it to the point where they have 30 seconds left at the very most in order to play that. Cause the clock's going to run out of 2 minutes before first down has even run. And they didn't have any timeouts. So you want to run two kneels. You could do it. Run again on third down, try get in, kick on fourth down as a fallback position for the tie in overtime. I was really bothered by that. And I thought that's something that should come from a high level. I mean, they have coaches who are doing that. Daniel Stern is looking at that as we go. So,
yeah, I guess I would say a two or a three, not too high up on the old ranker list. I do think it is tied to something that, I've been thinking about. And I talked about on our podcast earlier tonight, and I've talked about on earlier podcast recording, just the idea that the thing John Harbaugh was intentional about this offseason was bringing a competitiveness to doing the small things better. I mean, you were there.
Ball starts. Yep.
I think at training camp, that is actually one of the things that they did, that they were intentional about and got better at. But I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Ken, but I think you were probably there for some of the, post training camp practice availabilities where either Harbaugh was asked about or guys talked about how there was this leaderboard where coaches were keeping track of all the things that the Ravens wanted to do better fundamentally, mm-hmm. from, the Raven Claw for protecting against fumbles, to cutting down on penalties, to running to the ball, to, making plays on the ball, getting turnovers, getting touchdowns, all that kind of stuff. And my thought was that, okay, you are doing the things that you need to eradicate any possibility of you dropping a dumb game to Cleveland in November. Maybe this doesn't help you put you over the top against the Bills in Buffalo or the Chiefs in Kansas City. You have to play them in the playoffs, but you're at least giving yourself as much margin for error as possible in the regular season so that maybe you do enough to get that one seed or get that two seed and set yourself up for another AFC championship game in Baltimore. And yet all of these things that John Harbaugh was intentional about with these players.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with the promo code Ravens. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The Sleepy Time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code Ravens at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
Every day, companies you've never heard of are making millions off your personal data. Your name, address, phone number, even details about your family are pulled from public records on the internet, then sold without your consent. There's an entire marketplace built on your privacy, and most people have no idea it exists. Aura fights back. Aura removes your personal data from broker sites and keeps it off. Aura also alerts you fast if your information shows up in a breach or on the dark web. But Aura is more than just a data broker removal system. It's a full digital security suite that protects every part of your online life. Aura gives you a VPN to stay private, antivirus to block threats, a password manager for safer logins, and spam call protection to shut down scammers. Aura scans the dark web for your most sensitive information and notifies you instantly if anything is exposed. And if your identity is ever stolen, you're backed by up to $5 billion in insurance and 24/7 U.S.-based fraud support. Other service charges about the same, but only cover one or two areas. Aura gives you everything. Data broker removal, identity and credit monitoring, device protection, and fraud support all in one simple app. Aura removes what's already exposed, protects what's not, and puts you back in control. Go to aura.com/remove for complete digital protection and peace of mind. That's aura.com/remove.
There's so little that came to fruition. Like they got a couple more takeaways, but was that because they were playing terrible, terrible quarterbacks for the middle third of the season? Derrick Henry fumbled, which is something that he never does. Yep. They had fewer penalties, but then they kind of came roaring back at the end of the season and some very high leverage spots. The tackling, which I think was pretty strong for a good part of the season, just went completely up in smoke against a very undynamic Steelers skill position group, aside from those running backs. So to see like John Harbaugh be so committed and so intentional to lifting this team up and trying to get them better, only for them to backslide in basically every phase of the game except special teams was pretty galling.
Yeah. I do think that they probably were able to run their offense more efficiently with a broader set of cadences because they were effective with the false starts. I think they got that. And some of that's hidden to us, Jonas. I mean, it really is.
I know. And that's the frustrating thing with talking about John Harbaugh is so much of what he's done and the value that he brings to any organization is hidden. It's the culture. It's like making these guys so in love with the weight room that they miss out on talking to us friendly faces in the media. Like there are so many little invisible edges that John Harbaugh has given this team, and some of them have eroded in recent years. Like the special teams wasn't great last year. Like the physicality in the trenches, so at least on the offensive side of the ball, definitely wasn't there. But so much of this stuff is just unquantifiable. Like there's no DVOA for weight room. There's no DVOA for culture. And that is something that the next coach is going to have to reckon with. And if, you know, it looks better on an X and O's perspective for whoever the next coach is, but you're still wondering why the Ravens are losing these dumb games, well, it's probably because like the Ravens have taken a step back in other areas that we just don't have the capacity to really quantify.
Right. I would agree. That's certainly a risk, and it's one that could show up in a lot of different find those inches are out there everywhere, like in any given Sunday. You know, we look at certainly this Ravens job as being the most attractive job now in all of sports, maybe not just all of the NFL, in terms of what it comes up.
Take that, Manchester United.
Yeah. It's sad for me. I still don't consider, you know, the English Premier League as part of the American sports scene. Although I do want English fans rooting for our football team. You know, they had a really open process for this in 2008. I know you probably weren't plugged into it nearly where you
freshman
were.
Freshman in Maryland.
Fresh out of Maryland. There you go.
So no, freshman at Maryland.
Freshman at Maryland. There you go. So you're really seeing the area, but they did a wonderful job. And I still want to dig up the piece that they wrote for the season ticket holders. The PSL owners got a special booklet talking about the hiring process after Billick was let go. And it's fantastic. I mean, it was fantastic. I handed it out to all the other senior officers at work because I said, this is great hiring practice right here. And, you know, Bisciotti from his hiring background, he not only made it open to the fans in terms of what was happening, just the process itself stood up to the kind of scrutiny that I would, you know, ask for in terms of a hiring process is done for someone who's hired in your own department. It was one of these things that was very impressive about the entire Bisciotti era. And I don't think we would have seen it during the Modell era. We certainly didn't see it when Billick was hired. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
I wonder if they'll go that route. Do you sense that Steve B would repeat what he's done, that it was a function of his background? Or do you think this is maybe something that Kevin Byrne thought was a great idea and Chad Steele might not think is a great idea?
Yeah, I would say that transparency is no longer rules the day in Baltimore. Obviously this is a different generation, or it's a different media environment. I think, you know, Adam Schefter and Ian Rappaport, or I guess at least Adam Schefter, were, you know, dominant news gatherers back then, but not everything was as atomized as it is right now in terms of how we consume news. So it's hard for me to remember the last like massively transparent coaching search in any kind of, you know, Big Four sport, at least as far as like how the team presents it. I think obviously these teams, I believe, at least when it comes to like coordinator searches, are compelled to report who they've had interviews with. I guess that also applies to head coaches as well. Cause like
just stop you for a second there, because it's not the who that was impressive about this. It's the how, the, you know, the why and the what did they ask them? And it detailed this entire process where, you know, so-and-so picked him up at the airport and they conducted the first interview on the way on the car out to the castle. You know, and then he dropped him off and he met with A and B and C. I mean, it was like that. And even at that time, you probably remember, but Garrett was their first choice and they offered the job to him. And then he took the Cowboys job and they didn't have any problem reporting that. And I was like, this is really amazing. And you're saying you can't remember the last time. I can't remember any other time anything has been this transparent in any sport about how they did it. And that's why I'm really trying to find this article again. I've got it here somewhere because I know I didn't throw it away, but I can't put my hands on it right now. And I'm hoping the Ravens can get me a copy of it, but I would love to see that.
Well, if you do find it, let me know, because I would love to
share it with you. I'll share it with you. Yeah. And I hope I'm not making too much of it, but it was, you know, you never see this kind of transparency, and they took us through that. Okay. Maybe we talk quickly about who there else. It will make the one big thing is a CEO coach versus a coordinator. You made the point earlier that, you know, a CEO coach is what Harbaugh is. He has a lot of advantages to it. One of the nice things about having a CEO coach from my perspective is you don't have to fire the guy when his side of the ball is going wrong. So if you have a defensive coordinator, defensive caller, who's also the head coach, and your defense isn't operating properly, then you probably have to fire the head coach to get rid of the defensive coordinator. I don't like that, but there are some advantages, certainly. You see, the other side of it is, but you don't lose the coordinator like you did with McDonald, because, you know, he wants to make head coaching money.
Right.
Yeah. Where are you on where they would land on this if Bisciotti had candidates of both types available?
I guess it just really depends on the quality of candidates that would be available. I mean, I'm kind of viewing this through the lens of, does Bisciotti see this as a win now type of setup? And if it is a win now type of setup, and you could say that, like, with this team and the talent that it has, and I know, like, people will complain about the holes and everything, but, like, if you look around the league and you look at the supposed contenders for 2026, and you see like who they're bringing back or who they're poised to lose or how much cap space they have or how much cap space they don't have for 2026, I think the Ravens are still very, very well positioned to be like a top five team next year in terms of like preseason Super Bowl odds. It's just, I know it's easy to be fatalistic about this team and the holes it has, and like, how could you be counting on Roquan and Marlon to, you know, coming back with that huge cap space or with those huge cap hits? Well, I think a lot of teams have a lot of contracts they probably would like to do over right about now, and that they manage. And I think the Ravens will also manage, but it's hard for me to see Steve Bisciotti, considering the coaches who are out there, like being willing to give a coach who doesn't have a clear, be willing to give a CEO style coach who doesn't have a clear coordinator in mind, who he knows will be an instant smash success, why would he in any world pick that over a coach who's going to come in and be an immediate floor raiser on one side of the ball? Like, you don't have the time with Lamar Jackson turning 29 today, by the way. Happy birthday, Lamar, to really take your chances with this being like a 2-year experiment with a certain coordinator on one side of the ball. Like, you need to make sure that this guy comes in right away and hits the ground running right away on his specified side of the ball. And so that's the way I'm kind of looking at it. Like, you know, the quote that I cited in my story about Harbaugh's firing was when, you know, Garrett Downing was interviewing Steve Bisciotti and John Harbaugh at the owners meetings in April, I think it was. Like, he asked this kind of softball question about, you guys are coming up on the 30-year anniversary of this Ravens franchise. How do you envision the next 30 years going? And Steve Bisciotti gave like a, I don't give a damn about the next 30 years. I want to win now type of answer. And I think if you apply that logic to who the next coach will be, it will be someone who brings in a very specific set of skills right away to help one side of the ball, whether that is lifting this Lamar Jackson offense or bringing someone who can fix this defense that was nowhere nearly as good as it should have been. So I think that's just how I would kind of, that's the prism through which I'm viewing this current setup.
Okay. All right. Well, fair enough. I'm not sure the guy is there, but you know, one of the people who, I'm not sure he's an obvious defensive coach. I am sure he's a leader of men. I'm not sure he's ready for a head coaching role other than as a leader of men is Anthony Weaver. He's not really been talked about as right. a guy, but we've seen the guy operate around camp. I mean, you know, players completely relate to and respect him. I'm not sure, you know, even he's been the defensive coordinator at Miami this last year. I don't know if he's any good. You know, Miami's, you know, not a particularly fantastic team, but they did do some things on defense this year to get a little bit of success later in the year. I'm more impressed with what Weaver would bring as a leader if you wanted a CEO right. coach. And I just haven't heard his name in the mentions so far.
Yeah. I mean, he's very well liked in Baltimore, but obviously I think the past 2 years for him, it's been like 19th in DVOA for defense, 26th in defense for DVOA. Obviously that those Miami defenses have been one, drained of talent, and two, mm-hmm. heavily injured. So you wouldn't put a whole lot of stock into that, but I think it would make it a very, very tough sell to the fan base and I even like to your coaching staff if you bring him in.
Could be. I mean, I don't know. It's what you have left of your coaching staff is what you've got to worry about. And there might not be a whole lot of it. If you're saying you know, there's six guys you want to retain or whatever. Well, sure. I mean, most of the guys are going to be at a lower level. The new linebackers coach they got last year, whose name is escaping me right now, the inside linebacker guy.
I know you're talking about.
Yeah. Okay. And they have a new double D.
Yeah, Don Delosio.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so they have some guys at a lower level that they need to, that they, you know, probably want to keep.
Santucci.
Yeah. I one of the big things is going to be getting, I think, going out and getting a new, I hope, you know, long time offensive line coach. Because if you can afford to pay John Harbaugh $60 million to walk out the door, which is something like that, he's leaving with for the 3 years he's not getting paid for. I hope there's still enough money left to overpay some of the coaches that don't fall under the cap dollar constraints.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if you saw any of this on Twitter today, but there was just like a huge like outswell of support for the Falcons offensive line coach who I guess is a free agent right now. I'm trying to search for his name on Twitter.
Okay.
Brandon Thorne said, lost in the Falcons cleaning house is that offensive line coach Dwayne Ledford is again available after doing another really nice job this season. Big opportunity for a team to bring in one of the most underrated line coaches in the NFL. So I imagine if Brandon Thorne knows about him, then the entire offensive line community knows about him, which means that the entire offensive coaching community knows about him. But obviously it's one thing to know about a guy. It's another to actually bring him into your building.
Okay. So Dwayne Ledford is 49 right now. So he meets the standard of a lifer as an offensive line coach. Probably he's a guy probably not looking to be offensive coordinator somewhere And that's exactly the kind of dynastic hire I'd like to see at the position. And whether or not, I mean, Steve Bisciotti's not that much older than me. Maybe he's 5 years older. I'm not sure. You know, John Harbaugh's only 1 year older than me. You know, I am still looking down the road for the next, I want to see 25 more years of good football, even at age 62, as optimistic as that total number of years might be. I want to see that in front of me. So I would love to have a dynastic coach.
Yeah. You know, I was just talking about as an offensive line coach, not as someone who would be, who would come in and be a head coach. I'm just talking right. about, you know, like you said, you don't have to worry about the salary cap for your coaching hire. So just overpay for a guy like that. And maybe he is your version of Philly's, why am I like the Eagles offensive line coach who was so good there?
I'm blanking too, but that's okay. Dynastic.
Jeff Stoutland.
Position coaches are worth their weight in gold when you can find them, especially great ones. Front. Who and those who want to stay there at the position too, as opposed to, you know, wanting something more. It's okay. You want to have a certain number of upwardly mobile younger coaches who, you know, want to grow, and you want to grow the coaching tree and whatnot. And it should be something we aspire to, that we lose assistant coaches or head coach, you know, to other roles. You get paid off multiple ways for that. You get better head coaching hires you bring in. You also may get Rooney Rule picks out of it if you happen to have people of color in those positions. But either way, there's multiple ways you get paid off for being a CEO coach who brings in successful coaches under you.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay. You see the list of people here, and I'm just going to read off the list really quickly. Maybe give me 1, 2, 3 out of this list of the guys you think are most likely, and we won't spend more time on this, but these are in order by odds that were posted around 10 p.m. tonight. Most likely is Jesse Minter at 31% to do it. A 42-year-old coach, defensive, was a Michigan guy under Jim Harbaugh, and now is with the Chargers as defensive coordinator, I guess.
Are you not going to
let me rattle off the whole list, right? Yeah. If we go over each of these, and we'll spend time on all of them. Yeah. Kevin Stefanski, just fired by the Browns, is at 11%. He's an offensive side of the guy. Clint Kubiak, 38, is an offensive guy, 9%. Brian Flores, 44, 9% on defense. He has an outstanding lawsuit with the NFL. Cliff Kingsbury, 7%. He's a 46-year-old offensive coordinator. Robert Saleh. You mentioned he may have more of a CEO kind of a personality to him, a 46-year-old guy, though. Definitely a defensive background. They have at 5%. Marcus Freeman, a 39-year-old guy, defensive background at 3%. Bill Belichick, I think that's just some sucker money there. At 73, a defensive coach, obviously, for most of his career. Mike LaFleur, an offensive coach at 38, 2%. And Chris Shula, that's kind of an emerging name and a hot one, a defensive coach with the Rams at 2% and age 39. Where are you on those guys? Who do you think are names that we're going to hear more from?
Yeah, I guess I'll highlight four guys just who I think are most interesting. There are a lot more than four that are interesting, but I just want to talk about a couple of them. I think obviously Jesse Minter is a natural pick as a front runner in this, not the front runner, but just a front runner in the search because of his ties to the Ravens. I don't think his relationship to John Harbaugh should be disqualifying, because obviously Ravens fans would have loved to have had Mike McDonald as coach, and he obviously came up under John Harbaugh. You know, he has done a great job in LA without a huge surplus of talent on that Chargers team. You know, he's made it viable with Tony Jefferson coming out of basically retirement.
He's been a hell of a player this year.
Yeah. You know, he I don't think a top three pass rushing group of Khalil Mack, Tuli Tuiopoto, I'm butchering his last name, and Adafi Owe is that overwhelming, but he's made it a high pressure group. You know, he's able to find ways to defend the run out of light boxes, out of two eye structures. I think that's a must in the modern NFL. We obviously know that, you know, he comes from that coaching background. His father was a longtime college coach, so this is something that in his blood. It's something that, you know, he's very comfortable doing. So I think that would be a very, very smart fit for the Ravens if he passes the interviews with flying colors. I think Clint Kubiak is interesting because a lot of what he does, I don't know if it necessarily makes the best use out of Lamar. Like they have been last year in previous stops that he's been in, he's relied on a lot of under center stuff. You know, it's a lot of the familiar Shanahan type schemes where it's, you know, going under center, using outside zone, using boots to get to where you want to in the pass game. He's talked about, you know, wanting to be balanced, which I think is obviously would be the watchword for any Ravens play caller on offense. You know, you want to have multiple ways to beat defenses, but I do wonder if the fact that there's not a lot of shotgun, not a lot of pistol proof of concept on the tape, at least to the volume that you would want, whether that could be something that might be disqualifying for him. Cliff Kingsbury,
let me stop you for a second.
Yeah,
I want to respond on Kubiak. You bring up an interesting point because we're talking about all the scheme that these guys would bring to the thing. The Ravens offense has been terrific in terms of maintaining its own DNA, even from Roman to Monken, who are tremendously different in terms of how they coach offensive football. They kept a lot of that DNA in terms of how much they want to run the football. And there can be some self-scouting or some scouting from the previous years that Kubiak would come and be able to do before the season starts, obviously, or work with Lamar on things. But it does really bring up the question is how are they going to deal with maintaining offensive DNA when you don't have anyone overseeing it anymore?
Right. Yeah. Brian Flores, I think would be another is number four interesting guys for me. What he's done with that Vikings defense the past couple of years is incredible. I think top five in DVOA each of the past 2 years. And I think if you were to ask Ravens fans to name more than a couple guys on that defense, they would probably just look at you with blank stares, like Andrew Van Ginkle.
Yeah.
Sure. Dallas Turner has really come on strong this year as a former first round pick, but it really hasn't been a whole lot from him. They lost Cam Bynum, who was a tremendously impactful player from that secondary in 2024. They lose him in 2025, and yet they still keep on trucking. But obviously the two big, you know, blinking red or blinking yellow lights with his candidacy are, as you said, not just the pending lawsuit against the NFL and a couple teams, which seemed to get in the way of him really getting any traction in the head coaching cycle last year. Like I thought for sure he would be two and done with the Vikings, but that wasn't the case. And maybe he gets a little bit more traction this year, but also just the fact that, you know, you do wonder about his, his fit in a culture like the Ravens. And by culture, I don't mean like the locker room, just the kind of reaching across the aisle, the collaborative nature that you have with Eric DaCosta, with Ozzie Newsome, even with Steve Bisciotti in getting stuff done. And I think Ryan Fitzpatrick last year said this, and I think he was recirculated again in this coaching cycle, like toward the end of that tenure in Miami. I believe he said that Brian Flores had turned into a dictator. Like, and I think someone who's given a label like that by someone as prominent as Ryan Fitzpatrick is going to have to do a lot to prove that he will not become just a domineering asshole, pardon my French, at his next stop. So just because someone is as, you know, influential and impactful and fun to watch as Brian Flores, maybe there are just some owners who believe that that is the station that they should never rise above. And that's a shame, because it would be awesome to see Brian Flores. It would be awesome to see a Kyle Hamilton type in a Brian Flores offense, but it may never get that. And then the last guy for me.
Well, hold on for Flores. Let me just make a comment on that. There's one thing to be a dictator with your defense. And the reaching across the aisle stuff, the main place I don't want that showing up, and I think part of the value of getting rid of Harbaugh, frankly, is I think he was having an undue influence on the draft, even with a person like DaCosta, who's very strong at the helm. Mm-hmm. This will not be a strong head coach system with a subservient general manager, and it shouldn't be. It's right. Separate silos. It's, you know, it's not the EDC will not be just simply doing the bidding of the head coach. So Flores is really upset. So we saw the movie Draft Day and whatnot. You remember how it was a Leary character?
I never watched it.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, he was very, very loud about wanting a running back at number 7, you know, kind of thing. And it was sure. Just like, this guy has too much influence on the draft process. Why isn't he, you know, subservient to that? But anyway, I would not want Flores trying to tell EDC how to do his job.
Right. And I should say, actually, since we're doubling back on Flores, I did ask John Jenkins about him. And I think John Jenkins played for him, I believe, in 2021, which actually would have been his last year there. Let me just double check. So yeah, John Jenkins was there 2021 and 2022. So I think he got fired after 3 years in Miami from 2019 to 2021.
Yep.
Because I was talking to John for just a retrospective on that Cover Zero game, Ravens Dolphins, that obviously is seared into so many Ravens fans' collective memory. And John, like off the record, you know, not for a story or anything, told me that he didn't feel like he had any problems with Brian Flores. In fact, he liked him. So he was a guy who, you know, would have had free reign to kind of bash him. He wasn't a big part of that Miami defense, certainly not as big a part as he is on this Ravens 2025 defense. But it was notable to me that he didn't have anything bad to say about Brian Flores. Mm-hmm. And obviously, like, Brian Flores was the head coach of that team. He wasn't just the defensive play caller. So that is something just to kind of consider. And then Chris Shula, it was actually kind of surprising that he was as low as the oddsmakers have him, because I do think he is, you know, pretty widely considered a rising star in this league. I mean, the fact that I think the Rams last year were what, like 25th thereabouts. Let me look it up. Last year they were 26th in defensive DVOA, and this year they are 4th, despite having one of the NFL's youngest defenses. Mm-hmm. Just really impressive that they've been able to rebuild that pass rush without Aaron Donald. They've been able to get like career best play out of guys that we all thought were lost causes, like Emmanuel Forbes. They turned an undrafted no-name linebacker in Nate Landman into a just really productive, you know, central cog in that defense. And then, you know, as far as a guy whose narrative would be, I think, pretty easy to sell to Baltimore fans, at least Baltimore fans of a certain age, you know, he is the son of a former Baltimore Colts player. It was a brief stint, but Dave Shula
I was gonna say he's the grandson of a Baltimore Colts coach. That's how we
and
know.
Yes, him. He's the grandson of Don Shula, who's obviously a Baltimore Colts coach. Baltimore Colts coach here.
And you know, one of the funny stories Art Donovan always told about he lived with Shula and three other guys for a year, and he says, then we all got married. And anyways, there's always a pause, and he goes, you get married to girls, not each other. It's just Art Donovan really knew how to get the timing down on a story. But I would probably agree on three of those four as being guys. I don't think that the landmines that come with Brian Flores are necessarily worth the trouble. I would Kubiak, Minter, Shula. If I were to add a fourth, I might be tempted to give Robert Saleh another choice, just because of the chance that he could be a CEO head coach. But you know, you've got the guys in the right age range there. So your guys are 38, 39, 42, and 44. I think it's going to be someone between the ages of 37 and about 50 who gets this job. I don't think that gives you a chance for a dynasty coach. It gives you a chance for, you know, a 15-year run again. And frankly, it's a job that requires a lot of, it's a highly physically demanding job being a head coach. We watch, even watching Rex Ryan when he was with the Jets on Hard Knocks and all the problems he had with his eating habits and whatnot, that's hard to watch, you know, in terms of a guy. I mean, just, he was not long for this league at that moment, you know, in his life. You know, Harbaugh is much more suited to longevity in the league with his, you know, willingness to work out, get up early to do so and whatnot.
Right.
I did have these guys on our initial head coaching list just as kind of long shot guys. But if I'm Steve Bisciotti, I'm at least like exploring the possibility of someone like a Dan Lanning, the Oregon mm-hmm. coach, or even a Kurt Cignetti, who does not fit into the age range for your would-be yeah. dynastic head coaching candidates. But what Dan Lanning has done in like keeping the Oregon offense humming with transfer quarterbacks who've really, really been impressive, while having himself be a defensive head coach. Like, he was the defensive coordinator for a national championship winning Georgia team, and has I guess is very, very well regarded for the kind of sim pressures that he's been able to use at the college level. I think, you know, that there are a lot of qualities there that I think would play at the NFL level, and certainly you'd have to pay a big buyout, and who knows if, you know, he even wants to leave college for the NFL. But I think, you know, one thing that Albert Breer has said that I think is true about pretty much all these guys is the work-life balance at the NFL is so much more desirable than what it is with college.
Really? Oh, because of the recruiting requirements now.
Yeah. I mean, you even, I doubt you saw this, Ken, with the kind of work that you were up to tonight, but Damond Williams, I believe is how it's pronounced, you know, just 4 days ago signed a contract to return as Washington's quarterback, you know, had a very, very good year for the Huskies this year, but actually maybe there's some under the table dealing there, because now he's trying to get out of that contract and go back into the, and go into the transfer portal to probably be paid God knows how many millions of dollars by, like, let's say in Oregon, if they are expected to lose Dante Moore to the NFL draft, or an LSU, which obviously will be flush with cash now that, or I guess it's always been flush with cash, but really flush with cash from boosters looking to help make the transition there away from Brian Kelly to, why am I blanking on his name, the Ole Miss coach who just went there. God, I should know this. Let's see. Lane Kiffin. Duh. Wow, okay. I'm such an idiot. Everyone's yelling at me through their phones right now listening to it. But like, even though a Dan Lanning or a Kurt Cignetti has never coached in the NFL, imagine going back in time in 2008 and saying that Steve Bisciotti's next coach, the guy to replace Brian Billick, would have been a guy who had spent a lot of his later career in Philly coordinating special teams and then spending yeah. 1 year as a defensive backs coach.
Yeah, it's strange. And I think the search is going to have a very wide net to it. And I think the Ravens will be better at finding unusually good candidates from somewhere further down. It's a great opportunity. It's one of the most exciting jobs, obviously, that's been out there in recent years. So hopefully some very desirable candidate is going to be paired with it.
Yeah, they should. I mean, I can't think of the last time a job this good came open.
Yeah. All right, Jonas, really appreciate you taking as long as you did tonight. Obviously, a lot of rabbit holes we went down during this. We were expecting this to be a 30-minute show, and I appreciate you. It is now 2:01 a.m. for folks at home if you're wondering how late Jonas is staying up and when not to call him in the morning. But thanks for coming on. Tell folks where they can find your work online or maybe ask a question.
Yeah, thebanner.com is where we had a bunch of good stuff go up tonight. We have a reflection on John Harbaugh's journey in Baltimore by Giles Walker, who obviously, you know, has been on the show several times. Some behind the scenes stuff from Jana Han, just a normal, you know, retrospective slash look, you know, normal news story on the story by me. List of coaching candidates by me. And I'm sure we'll be cranking out content over these next couple of days.
Okay. All right. Great to have you. Other folks out there, thanks so much for listening. As always, use hashtag film study mailbag. If you have questions, try to answer them either with a video or get them put on the appropriate short in this off season. Next set of shorts that are coming up are on the positional reviews. We'll be looking forward to hearing from you on those. Jonas, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you, Ken. Appreciate you having me.
And we'll talk to you next time on film study. All right.